Good morning. Welcome. Set your cell phones on stun. Good morning and welcome to session 301, Gratitude, a Contagious Choice, given by Francis Menlove. I'm Carol Quist, a member of the Sunstone staff, and we'll give a couple of reminders. Our book room is in the Deer Valley room at the end of the hall. Make a left turn. Several vendors are there, including Benchmark Books, and there will be author signings at 1:30 in the lunch break. There are a few banquet tickets available. If anyone's plans have changed so that you're free to come tonight to the banquet, see me about buying a ticket. The CDs are being produced in wonderful shape, in good time, and they are out at the registration table. Francis? Has allowed me to tell you that we were classmates in high school and college, and it is not her fault. She has a master's and PhD in psychology, is one of the founders and first manuscript editor of Dialogue, a journal of Mormon thought. We will hear from her now. No Q&A at the end.
She said to put my chin on.
I should have said nose.
Nose. She should have said nose. How is that? Can you hear? Okay. Thank you so much for coming. I'm always impressed with anybody who can get out here at 8 o'clock in the morning. And what we're going to talk about today is gratitude. And gratitude is a choice. But I'm going to begin with a story. Very first thing, right off, a story. And this story begins, as all good stories should, with once upon a time. Okay. Once upon a time, there was a peddler who made his living by traveling to the market each Saturday to sell his wares from his horse-drawn cart. He traded in tools, odds and ends, of farm equipment, and occasionally random housewares. One day, in preparation for the trip, he laid some squash and two bushels of fresh corn on top of the tools, and at the last minute, his wife added a bag of recently harvested sugar beets. But when he was ready to go, the horse would not move. The cart was simply too heavy. He walked carefully around the cart, surveying the inventory, but he could see nothing that wasn't absolutely essential. Nothing could be left behind. But he knew he had to lighten the load. He knew that it was time for a decision. After careful thought, he made his choice. He took off the wheels. The moral of this parable is, of course, to look thoughtfully at our choices and to be careful about removing the things that propel us on our journey. As Albus Dumbledore, headmaster of Hogwarts School for Wizards, counseled, it is our choices, Harry, that show what we truly are, far more than our abilities. One of the choices we have in life is something that is not often considered a choice at all, and that is gratitude. Certainly gratitude is that spark that arises in us when we're thankful for even the smallest everyday courtesy, a stranger picking up a paper for us that we've dropped, or holding the elevator for us, or showing us how to pick out ripe mangoes in a supermarket. We smile when we see pigtails bouncing as a child runs. or light reflected off our grandmother's glass face, or a bird on the tree outside the window. Each moment may be an occasion for gratitude. But maybe gratitude can be more than a spontaneous pleasant emotion. Maybe it can be an attitude of heart, and an attitude that we can actually choose. Maybe gratitude is the wheels on the cart that help us move forward each day. Now, gratitude has always been considered a major virtue by philosophers and theologians. Gratitude is prominent in all the ancient writings and modern scriptures, in Islam, Hinduism, Buddhism. Religions, even with all their differences of belief and ritual and all their claims of uniqueness and superiority, still all consider gratitude a major virtue. The ancient Roman philosopher Cicero said, "Gratitude is not only the greatest of virtues, but the parent of all other virtues." The parent of all of other virtues. Moving up to the present day, Gordon B. Hinckley said, "Gratitude is the very essence of worship." The very essence of worship. Recently, social scientists, well aware of the core place of gratitude in philosophical and religious discourse, have taken up the study of gratitude in earnest. The research supports the important role gratitude has for our sense of well-being and our personal happiness. In one study, participants were divided randomly into three different groups. Each group was to write down five things about the previous week. One group wrote down five things they were thankful for. Another group wrote down five hassles they'd had. And group three just listed any five things. The researchers found in this and several subsequent experiments that the groups which kept weekly gratitude journals reported more progress toward their personal goals, were more optimistic, felt better about their lives, and even exercised more than those who kept the journals of the hassles or weekly journals of neutral life events. I love the part about the gratitude group exercising more. In another really well-known study, Seligman devised what he called the gratitude visit. It works like this. You think of a person in your life who has been kind to you, but whom you've never really, really properly thanked. And then you write a detailed gratitude letter to that person. Then you visit the person and read the testimony aloud. According to Seligman, this ritual, and it is a ritual, is powerful. Everyone cries when you do a gratitude visit, he says. It's very moving for both people. One researcher on gratitude had subjects think of memories that inspire gratitude each time they think of them. Memories came up such as the baby's first smile, the sighting of the Hale-Bopp comet, watching robin eggs hatch from an upstairs window, a child's graduation from college. As I was conjuring up a memory I was grateful for, I was surprised at what popped up. I was visiting my grandkids, and I could hear a lot of riotous laughter downstairs. So on my way downstairs to see what was so funny, I stopped and saw my three-year-old giggling grandson. His two older brothers were teaching him to march around the playroom in the basement, chanting, "Amster, Amster, damn, damn, damn. Amster, Amster, damn, damn, damn." They thought that was a riot. The social science research of the last several years has concluded that gratitude is positively related to happiness and life satisfaction and inner peace and empathy, and negatively correlated with anxiety and depression. In other words, perhaps Cicero was right. Gratitude is a parent virtue, a virtue that sends out ripple effects, a virtue that nurtures other virtues. The ancient philosophers, theologians, the scriptures of many religions, and contemporary social science all are in agreement. Gratefulness is positively good for us. But can you really choose gratitude? Or is it just something that arises spontaneously? Can we choose to see the world as a gift? Can we decide, make a decision to live gratefully? Emmons has devoted his research career to what he calls the new science of gratitude. He emphatically asserts that gratitude can really be a choice. It doesn't depend on circumstances or genetic wiring or something we don't have control over. It really becomes an attitude that we can choose that makes life better for ourselves and for other people. He also presents evidence that material possessions are not what drive and sustain a disposition toward gratitude. I think that's interesting, but I'm not surprised. One more thing. Gratitude may be contagious. Contagious. Not exactly the way yawns are contagious, or the way, you know, how we laugh at a funny movie in a theater full of people more than we laugh at the same movie at home. Not exactly like that. But still contagious. Where we humans are susceptible to catching other people's emotions, like anger and fear and gratitude. The emotions have a ripple effect on people around us. Now, I'm going to stop. Consider me stepping aside for a minute. This is a word of warning. This is a beware. What I'm not talking about. I want to explain what I'm not saying or even implying with this look at gratitude. I am not talking about some of the popular and, to me, a tad bizarre versions of the power of positive thinking that are going around. There is a brand of pop psychology and pop religion that starts with making a case for gratitude or thinking positively about all the things that inhabit our lives. And from this tiny, modest beginning, they move with agility through all manner of slippery reasoning and theological sleight of hand, and end up encouraging the denial of reality and explaining patiently to us that whatever happens is always for the best, and that whatever ails you or ails me can be traced back to our own negativity. Maybe you've heard some of this. This philosophy often presents correlation, two things that correlate, as though it implies or proves causation, and ends up by asserting that whatever you want is yours for the taking or the acting or the visualizing or whatever. And I know my description of this popular philosophy is a bit of a caricature, but I just want to make it clear I'm not supporting the abandonment of critical reasoning. I think there's no single formula for coping with the pain of living. What I am talking about is more akin to what Carl Sagan, Carl Sagan suggests is a kind of a deep, profound gratitude, almost a sense of awe. Now, all you cooks in the audience, listen to Sagan's mini meditation. This is what Sagan has to say. This is what he says to think about. If you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first create the universe. If you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first create the universe. Gratitude seems to provide an internal framework for processing and reprocessing the events in our lives. A framework of awe, a framework of thankfulness. Gratefulness is the way the heart remembers. One more story. I think we often learn best from stories. And we've had a few sessions here at Sunstone this time that have talked about stories and how important they are. Stories can make our ears attentive to wisdom. This is a Buddhist story. I recently visited a Buddhist monastery in Korea, and the monk that greeted us suggested we open our minds and let the winds waft through them. That was what he said. Let the winds waft through your mind as we proceeded up the stairs to this ancient temple. So now open your minds as you hear this story and listen deeply, and let this ancient tale have its way with you this morning. There were two Buddhist monks, one somber and one joyful, living miles and miles apart. The first monk prayed all day long in deep, motionless silence. The second monk would sing and dance his praises to God near a huge tree in the monastery garden. One day, an angel appeared to the first monk and said, "I have come from God, and you have been given permission to ask God one question. What is your question?" The somber monk looked up and said, "How many lives must I live before I will attain self-realization?" The angel left him and reappeared miles away to the second monk, who was singing and dancing before God. The angel said, "I have come from God, and you have been given permission to ask one question of God. What is your question?" Without hesitation, the joyful monk asked, "How many more lives must I live before I will attain self-realization?" And with that, the angel disappeared. 1 week later, the angel returned to the first somber monk and said, "I have the answer you seek. You must live 3 more lives before you attain self-realization." With that, the first monk fell down dejectedly into heavy sobbing. 3 more lives, 3 more lives. "Oh no," he cried, 3 more lives. The angel left immediately and appeared to the second monk. "I have your answer," the angel said. "Do you see that tree around which you have been dancing and singing your praises to God?" "Yes," said the joyful monk. "You must live as many lives as there are leaves on that tree before you will attain self-realization," the angel said. The monk looked up at the tree. Why, there must be 10,000 leaves on that tree. "Only 10,000 lives? Only 10,000 more lives and I will attain self-realization?" And the monk began to sing and dance joyfully before God. Suddenly, a deep voice thundered from the heavens. "My child, this day you have attained self-realization." This story depicts gratitude as almost a state of being. Almost a state of being. The joyful monk is a living example of what President Hinckley had to say about gratitude being the essence of worship. Being grateful for the moon shining and orange on the counter, the open book on the table next to the chair, grateful when the right word comes to mind and a name is remembered, and a sense of humor when it doesn't. Grateful for the laughter of kids running around the front yard, and grateful for the incredible space photographs taken by that Hubble telescope. Just grateful for the gift of life. I want to emphasize in closing what intrigues me about this virtue of gratitude. I like the notion that gratitude is more than a spontaneous response to the gifts received. I like the idea that gratitude can be lived as a discipline, as a habit to be cultivated, a habit that can be learned and enhanced and becomes more a part of us with practice, a choice to be made, a contagious choice. A choice that may help us keep the wheels on our cart, or at least keep them greased a little, even when the load is heavy and our burden and truly burdensome. And a choice that may move us a smidgen closer to enlightenment. But the bottom line is, I believe that gratitude is a choice that Albus Dumbledore, that wonderful, wise headmaster of Hogwarts, would certainly approve of. Thank you for coming. One more thing. On your way out, there I have bookmarks for the cooks and the non-cooks. If you want, with Carl Sagan's meditation, which I love. So they'll be on the chair as you leave for anyone who would like one. Thank you.